Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Whoa! Potluck.
And welcome to another episode of Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yu.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we're here today to talk about our February 2020 book club pick, The Kiss Quotient by Helen Hong. And to help us discuss this book, we have a special guest. Rira, why don't you introduce her?
Okay, so we have my friend Caitlin Kelly on the podcast. She is also a co-host of mine. We do a podcast called Bestest Movie Ever, where a bunch of film school students talk about classic films that they should have watched in film school but totally didn't, and we talk about them. So thank you, Caitlin, for joining us.
Of course.
Caitlin was actually the one who introduced me to The Kiss Quotient. She read it first and was like, I think you would like this book. So coming full circle here.
Exactly.
And it's also a very special book to Caitlin because she found out that she was autistic after reading it. So we're going to talk more about that during our conversation.
Yeah, so let's just get started.
All right, I'm going to start with the book jacket description for those of you who do not care about spoilers.
Oh yeah, standard spoiler warning. We're going to be talking all about this book. So if you care about that stuff, go read the book right now. We'll wait, put us on pause, and when you come back, we'll be ready to talk all about The Kiss Quotient.
Okay. Stella Lane comes up with algorithms to predict customer purchases, a job that has given her more money than she knows what to do with, and way less experience in the dating department than the average 30-year-old. It doesn't help that Stella has Asperger's, or that French kissing reminds her of a shark getting its teeth cleaned by a pilot fish. Her conclusion, she needs lots of practice, with a professional, which is why she hires escort Michael Phan. With the looks of a K-drama star and the martial arts moves to match, the Vietnamese-Swedish stunner can't afford to turn down Stella's offer. And when she comes up with a lesson plan, he proves willing to help her check off all the boxes, from foreplay to more than missionary position. Before long, Stella not only learns to appreciate his kisses, but to crave all of the other things he's making her feel. Their no-nonsense partnership starts making a strange kind of sense. And the pattern that emerges will convince Stella that love is the best kind of logic.
Yeah. So where should we start with this?
So we're going to start with first impressions. And I am going to start with you, Marvin, considering that I made you read this. And actually, this was my second time reading this book. And I thoroughly enjoyed it because partly I knew that you were reading all the sex scenes.
You were imagining I was reading at the same time. I think, like I mentioned last episode, I listened to this book a good, I think, 70% of it on audiobook.
Oh, God.
So it was extra comfortable while I was driving.
Did anybody sit in your car while?
No, no. We live in LA where there's tons of time spent in traffic alone, which is great. The only time I kind of turned it down was when I had to order stuff through drive-thru. And I was like, the Starbucks person doesn't need to know I'm listening to this.
Or maybe they do.
Maybe they do. Maybe it's their kink. No kink shaming on this podcast.
I mean, so listeners of Books and Boba know that I am not the most versed in the romance genre, but I do know some things about it through osmosis and through, I mean, some of our books have had like one or two like love scenes in them. So I had some idea of what it would be. I kind of imagined it would be kind of like your like rom-com, which it kind of is. I did not expect 80% of it to be horny.
Oh, man. Yes.
That's really funny because 'cause I would expect it to be horny considering Michael's profession as an escort.
I guess. But it was like...
It was a lot there.
It was a lot of horny in there. There was a lot of just... I think when I watch rom-coms, in my head I would think, throughout this entire scene, there's no sex, but this person is probably really horny for that person right now.
Right.
Because you can see every thought in their head.
Well, I also feel like it would be reasonable to have your expectation based on the back description be more like Pretty Woman, which, like...
It is Pretty Woman.
That was how Rira sold it to me.
It is. No, it absolutely is. But then, like, obviously when you're watching a movie, they're doing a lot of, like, tasteful fades or, like, you know, like the piano scene where it's like, you know, they start making out and you're like, oh, you know they're going to bang. But it's also, like, the tasteful fade to black. this has absolutely no tasteful fades to black whatsoever.
It's very descriptive.
It's actually very tame compared to other romance novels that are out there.
And still less cringy, too.
That's true. Yeah.
I think I knew what I was in for the moment I saw the word cock in it. And I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're like, oh, we're in it now.
What about you, Caitlin? I know that you are more geared towards sci-fi and murder, just like me.
Yes.
So what compelled you to pick up The Kiss Quotient, which is the complete opposite of those genres? And how did you feel about it when you read it for the first time?
I'm really not a romance person in general. I have... tried to widen out my taste just a little bit because I used to have this very, like, I don't like romance. And I would watch, like, rom-coms here and there because they were, like, kind of easy to consume. But basically right before I read this book, a friend of mine, Ashley Quach, suggested reading The Hating Game because I was, like, going to Hawaii and I was like, oh, I need, like, a pool read. And she's like, read this one. And she is, like, super, super into romance. So after I finished that one, she recommended this one as well. And I was like, yeah, why not? Like, this was fun to read. And The Hating Game was, like, a really good, just, like, more of a straight rom-com. And then so when I read this, I was kind of expecting something, like, a lot more in that vein. Where it's not really getting into, like, super serious sort of, like, character traits or, like, conflicts. And so reading this, I was like, man, this is, like, less of a rom-com and more of, like, it is a lot more of a character study than I guess I had kind of anticipated. And so I finished it, and then I, like, basically, like, we can get to sort of, like, the big life-changing moment that happened, like, as I was reading / after I read this book. And then I essentially went back and I read it, like, all over again. And so, like, I've never done that with, like, kind of anything related to romance whatsoever. And I was also kind of surprised because, like, I think a big barrier for me in, like, written, like, romances is that, like, a lot of times the sex scenes are, like, aggressively unattractive to read. Like, a lot of, like, comparison of genitals to, like, flowers and stuff. I'm like, this is, like, a little much. Whereas this, like, even if it was still kind of, like you said, aggressively horny, I didn't find it, like, off-putting, so I think that, like, helped me kind of, like, get through that into sort of the meatier stuff that it explores.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say it's aggressively horny. I would just say it's very horny. I never thought it was, like, pushing its horniness on me. It was just there's a lot of horny going on, and I'm trying to see how many times I can get the word horny into this episode.
Yes.
Horny.
And it was kind of fun. It was really fun to just explore these two people trying to figure themselves out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
exactly.
I definitely prefer romance stories where it is a lot about character growth. It is about people who are trying to, like, figure out who they are and finding out, like figuring out their insecurities, because there is a lot of insecurity in this book from both sides. I read a lot of filthy fan fiction in my life, so the sex scenes were very, very tame to me.
Right.
Although when I read it the second time, I was like, oh, there are a lot of sex scenes. I did not, like, remember most of it.
Chapters dedicated to...
There was a chapter that was dedicated to it. I counted. It was 20 pages. the second time through, I was just kind of skipping through the sex scenes. I think that is a criticism that a lot of people had on Goodreads, that there were too many sex scenes, that they should have, like, cut down on the smut. And I do agree in a sense, because after, like, the first time, I'm like, like, first time when they, like, fully do it, I'm like, I'm good. Like, we don't need to, like, keep going here.
Yeah.
But I imagine there's some people who read it just for those scenes.
Oh, yeah. Right? I mean, that's the audience. And, you know, like, I picked this because February, Valentine's Day, this is our first adult romance novel. And the thing about, like, the romance novel industry, it's very white. And we've talked about this on the podcast, actually, our last episode about RWA and how problematic it has been in the past. So, like, of all the romance novels I've kind of heard and seen, like, in my inner circles, like, this is the first time I've seen, like, an Asian character as, like, the lead. And it's an Asian male character.
Yeah,
who, you know, it's not really the lead in anything. I mean, now with Crazy Rich Asians, it's kind of, like, expected.
Yeah. Or you're, like, widening out and at least having it in things like A Simple Favor with, like, Henry Golding being the, like, love interest. Like, there is at least a little bit of, like, maybe that being included. Absolutely not enough. But, yeah, I think that was also something that drew me to this book. It's just, like, it was different.
I mean, the caveat, though, is also the author already fan-casted her main character with Daniel Henney being mentioned several times.
So, yeah. Okay, the thing is, like, Daniel Henney, I mean, he's still fine, but he's up there in age. I feel like she should have picked someone who was a little bit more current in popularity.
Who's the new Daniel Henney then? Would it be Ross Butler or?
Oh, man, I don't know.
Because Henry Golding's still a little too old for this.
Yeah, a little bit too old. Yeah. Ross Butler, maybe.
For me, the second time I read it, I had recently worked at the Saturn Awards, and I'm horrible with names. Louis Tan.
Louis Tan. Yeah.
I met him and he was gorgeous in person. Super, super, super nice. And so that's just kind of like who automatically got put in, especially because he was there for like martial arts stuff.
It's true.
So I was like, okay, that's my guy.
Would he be too buff for this?
No, there's no. Okay.
The Rock.
I mean, like, Michael is super buff. And like, you can't be too buff for this role unless like the suit doesn't fit you. Then we have a problem with wardrobe.
He was wearing a suit. It was like silver heathered. It was very great. I was really into it.
So let's get into the characters because it is a very character driven novel. I want to start with Stella because she is the heroine of the book. And one of the things that is really great about this book is representation. We see a woman with autism be the romantic lead. And also, she's rich. Yeah. Like, when do you ever see that? Like,
exactly.
I mean, like, you've seen rich people in power go on rom-coms, but it's usually, like, a guy.
Yeah.
And it's usually the woman who's like, okay, like, I'll make this deal so I can, like, financially better myself.
Right. Like, I feel like the only time I've ever really seen in, like, a mainstream rom-com, like, the reverse is, like, The Proposal.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, like, the only time I can think of
it.
I really like the fact that she was extremely good at her job and was extremely passionate, and that was a good thing. Like, it wasn't just like, oh, you need to, like, relax, lady.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas, like, Michael has been like, oh, you're passionate at your job and you work weekends at 6 p.m. That's so you.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Exactly.
Like, I really like that part of the relationship. So, like, Caitlin, like, while you were reading the book, you found out that you may be autistic and you got diagnosed.
Yeah.
How was that?
It was kind of like a weird kind of synchronicity, I guess, where I, for the first time in a long time, like, went back to therapy, and I also changed psychiatrists. And I'd always had, like, throughout my life, these sort of difficult to explain things, like, other doctors had kind of, like, assigned to, like, anxiety or whatever, where, like, I, you know, going into crowded spaces, I would just, like, have this reaction that I couldn't really explain. I'd had, like, a panic attack before, so I knew that it was, like, different, but, like, sounds would really impact me, tactile sensations on my skin would really impact me, visual stimuli, like, I would have these very, like, sort of intense negative reactions, and doctors would be like, yeah, well, you're just having an anxiety attack. I'm like, I don't think I'm having an anxiety attack. It feels different. And then on the social side, I had a lot of issues where kind of all these classic things where, like, I would get very fixated on topics, but I would do really badly in school because I would, like, not be able to pay attention or sort of like operate within a classroom setting in a way that was like beneficial. And so I was like clearly very like smart and excelling like in tests. And like I was academically very curious, but I was also doing very poorly in school. And then I couldn't make friends. I always felt like from a young age, I remember explaining to my mom, and I would say this over and over, that I felt like an alien who had been sent to Earth and had to like learn how to be a person. Or like when I was a kid, like when I learned about robots, I was like, oh, I'm a robot. No one else is a robot, but I'm a robot. And as I got older, I was just kind of like, yeah, I guess this is how I am. Like sometimes it would really impact me, but I would try to just like kind of be like, well, what am I going to do? So when I switched doctors, there all of a sudden became this sort of thing where like separately they were like, yeah, dude, everything you're explaining, like that's autism spectrum disorder. Like that's what it is. And so I was like reading this book at the same time. And that really allowed me to sort of like take this diagnosis that I was getting that felt sort of like very different and vague for me. And I couldn't really see how it like applied to my life so much. And then reading this and having the sort of like kind of interior monologue of a woman who has it, who was represented very differently, because I think like in general in pop culture, when we represent people on the autism spectrum, it's like very, very like sort of more severe, not always like Rain Man severe, but like there's a show called like The Bridge, for example. And like when you watch that, like she's obviously like very clearly autistic, but to an extent where like she's reasonably not going to be able to move through the world in a way that like I have been able to, which is why like I think it's helpful that we've started describing as a spectrum versus just like you're autistic.
Yeah, that's the thing in this book. Like Stella is diagnosed with Asperger's, and that's not a diagnosis anymore that they give to children.
It's an outdated term.
It's an outdated term. It definitely gives like a very bad stereotype.
Yeah.
I will say that in a lot of pop culture, like it's usually like autistic men.
Exactly.
And autistic men tend to have very different symptoms than autistic women.
And experiences, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Helen Huang actually like lists a couple of reference books in her author's note.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of like depictions of like men with autism that are in positions like Stella. And I'm thinking of like Silicon Valley, where they're all like tech execs with seeing their focus, or like in Good Trouble.
Yeah. I mean, she is technically in tech, and it is Silicon Valley.
Yeah. Well, and I think that like the only other portrayal of autism that I actually related to at all was The Accountant, which was a Ben Affleck movie that came out like a few years ago. And that came out before I was diagnosed. And I remember in watching it, I was like explaining to people, like, I get, like, this is how I feel, like, I get this person. And so that, like, there are, like, a lot of clues throughout my life that, like, this was going to come. But having this sort of interior portrayal, I think, like, kind of everything from how she interacts with other people and the misunderstandings that she has, and they're not coming from a place of her being, like, stupid, but just, like, not knowing how to, like, navigate things or getting fixated on things that aren't maybe the best thing to get fixated on. The scene when she goes to Michael's family for dinner
awful.
For the first time.
That was and like awful.
And the plastic and stuff. I was like, man, I have absolutely, like, maybe not the specific thing. I have done this. I have, like, had the thing where, like, I didn't know how to let it go. I didn't know that, like, I was being, like, super not fun to be around. But it was also like the little things too, like the sensory stuff. I think that because it had been like assigned to me as being an anxiety disorder for most of my life, seeing it represented in the book, like whether it's in the club when she like can't handle that sort of stimuli, or even just like the feeling of her clothes on her skin.
Yeah, like she only likes French seams. She like only likes certain fabrics. And I know for sure that is a thing with you.
That is like such a huge, and it was funny because like my mom has recently been trying to get more into like learning about autism spectrum disorder and kind of like get clarity on it, because my father is also like on the spectrum, and it was me being diagnosed that helped him sort of start exploring this part of himself that he had no context for until like later in life, which has been like its own thing.
Yeah.
So it's made it easier for me to kind of go like reading about the French seams. I was like, I don't have to wear denim. I can just not do that. And man, I like wearing clothes a lot more now that I just like kind of stopped wearing the things that like made me feel horrible.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the author herself was undiagnosed for a long time, right?
Yeah. Actually, I read her author's note, and I think it really brings it home. She wrote, "What started as mere research for a book became a journey of self-realization. I learned that I am not alone. There are other people just like me, and very possibly my daughter, too. As I pursued and eventually attained a diagnosis at age 34, Stella, my autistic heroine, was born on the page. It has never been so easy for me to write a character. I knew her intimately. She came from my heart. I didn't have to filter my thoughts to make her socially acceptable, something I'd been unconsciously doing for ages. And this freedom allowed me to find my voice." Yeah, I think it's really interesting that Helen started writing this book because her daughter, who was in preschool at the time, her teachers were saying, like, oh, she might be on the spectrum. And, you know, she did some research, and it turns out she was like, oh, there's a lot of things in here that is what I'm going through. And, you know, that's how the character Stella came into play. I actually really liked a lot of Stella's inner monologues, because a lot of the time, like when we watch like pop culture stuff where you have an autistic character, it's like, oh, aren't they weird? And wow, like, isn't this really hurtful? Whereas like in the book, you're just like, okay, no, this is her thought process. She doesn't like being touched. She has hard time with eye contact, and it's not, and with like the Michael family scene, which was like, woof. It's like you understand like the family's perspective of like, oh, why is she being so like rude and just like being like a little bit too much. But in her mind, it's like, oh my God, there's like so much sensory stuff happening.
Yeah.
And don't they know that they're being poisoned? So like, in a way, like you get into her head and everything just kind of clicks.
Yeah. And going off that as well, I mean, a lot of times, like you mentioned, when you see autistic people portrayed in media, it is like, oh, they're just rude. That's just how they are. They don't care. They don't feel the same way you do. And it's what really struck me about having Stella's inner monologue is like the intense shame she feels for not being able to like communicate or get her feelings across, or just like see what other people are feeling. And it's something that she's very self-aware about, very self-conscious about. And it's like the crux of her development is kind of like being okay with that.
Yeah. Right? Well, and I think for me, that's been an interesting thing to sort of like be okay with in myself, and also sort of communicate to others, because a thing that like has come up a lot for me is so my dad works in sort of like international business, and he would often like take me around like the people he was working with. And it was partly because like, since my dad's also on the spectrum, he like got very good at talking to people, but sometimes he was like, oh, I need like a wingman as well. And it just turns out that like his wingman was also on the spectrum, which is like, whoops. But it kind of ended up being this interesting thing where like in order to get through those, I really just like super observed how other people interacted and how they did things. And so for me, a lot of people have been like, oh, well, you know, like it's super surprising to learn that you're autistic because you don't seem like it. And I was like, yes, I don't seem like it, but you do not see the internal calculus that I am doing in like literally every social situation, except for when like I know someone super, super well. Because for me, it's like I observed how people do eye contact. And so even though eye contact is super uncomfortable for me in general, I will like time like where I am looking.
And which is the thing she does in the book. She's like, oh, like you have to keep eye contact for 3 seconds.
Yep,
otherwise,
and then look somewhere else.
Yeah,
and then,
if you do it for longer, you look like a creep. Yep. If you don't do it at all,
you look like a creep. Yeah, exactly.
Pretty much.
You know, and so I think that was super, super well represented in the book. And for me, it was actually something that made me feel less lonely in my own diagnosis, because I was like, oh my God, like here, like, you know, because a lot of times, like when you see autism, it's in movies. So you're not getting that internal monologue of what someone's going through. Whereas with her, I was like, man, like I get this, because like every single thing she says to a lot of people, she's having to do the like internal math of like, ah, oh, do I do this? Do I do that? Like, how do I deal with this? The sort of shame that you constantly feel, or even just like confusion and self-doubt, not knowing how you're really coming off, not knowing like if other people are like sort of upset with you. My own family often would be like, oh, Caitlin's really harsh, or she's really like too honest or too brusque, or she like gets really intense about being touched. And so this diagnosis, I think, was also really helpful for my relationship with a lot of people close to me, where I could be like, hey, so here's the reason I am where I am. And also being able to advocate for myself and what I needed and being like, hey, actually, just ask before you touch me. Sometimes I'm good with touch. Sometimes I'm like, literally stand 10 feet away. I can't deal with this. And I think learning how to set boundaries and also learn that, like, it's okay for me to have those boundaries. I think that's something that's really well represented, where she's like, she's also challenging herself and expanding, like, how she feels about things while also learning that, like, her feelings are valid.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that reminds me of just, you know, she starts off believing that she's just bad at sex, bad at love. But, you know, you see through her inner monologues because she's always concerned about other people and what they're thinking and what they need from her.
Exactly.
And not really thinking about herself. And that's what, you know, Michael brings, is kind of this intense focus on what she needs.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that was, like, really refreshing about this book. I know that there's some discourse on Goodreads about what classifies as coerced consent and, like, how Michael is handling Stella's uncomfortable boundaries. But I really like the fact that she was the one with, like, all of the leverage. Like, she has the money. So, like, she's not doing this for money. Like, imagine if this book was, like, Stella was the one who was the escort. Like, it would be a very, very different book. Although, very similar in terms of relationships, because there are a lot of sex workers out there who, you know, their clients are like, oh, I think she's really into me. And then that kind of, like, ruins the relationship.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you kind of have that tension here. But it's very different because the woman is in power. She has the financial means. And also, like, she calls the shot. She's just like, this, I'm uncomfortable with kissing. And even though, like, she gets more familiar with kissing, she's like, okay, but you have to, like, this is what I really want to do. I really want to kiss you. But I want you to know that it's going to take a while for me to get used to this. And I really like the fact that when she's with Michael, like, I never felt like she was in danger.
Yeah.
Like, if she said, like, if she was very, very firm on, like, no, we're not doing this at all, that he would just back off.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's challenging her, saying, like, okay, well, like, this is a safe space. Like, you can trust me. And I think that is something that not just, like, autistic people kind of deal with, but also just, like, women in general, because we're so used to catering to other people, which is why it's, like, very hard to diagnose girls at a young age as opposed to boys. And just, like, women in general, like, they're told, like, you're not good enough. You're, like, you have to be, like, you have to have the perfect body. You have to act a certain way.
Right.
You have to, follow all of these social cues. And it gets very, very difficult. And you have a lot of insecurities about whether you're good at sex or good with relationships. So it wasn't just an autistic thing. This was something that I could relate to as well.
Yeah.
And when I was in relationships and I was like, hey, like, this is really uncomfortable. And you have to, like, have a lot of patience with me. So I was very, very, very glad to see that Stella was able to call the shots in a lot of the checklist stuff. I thought that was really cute, by the way.
Yeah.
The whole, like, checklist.
Yeah,
we're like,
exactly.
Okay, we are going to learn how to do a hand job.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to learn how to do foreplay. And I'm like, you know, they really should come up with
a checklist,
right. You know, in general.
Well, and I felt like for me, like, I understand, obviously, like, you know, the obvious caveat is, like, consent is a case-by-case thing. Every relationship is different, et cetera, et cetera. But I perceived it very differently when I was reading it, as a person on the spectrum. And, like, I don't know if the, questions of whether or not it was coerced or not are coming from people who are neurotypical or not. But for me, that resonated really strongly because I think that, like, communicating, kind of in any situation, but especially, like, sexually, what you are uncomfortable with doesn't necessarily, especially given, like, she is paying him to teach her how to be good at sex, I think communicating what you are uncomfortable with isn't necessarily a, like, yes or no on that action. I think you can say, hey, so this is a thing that scares me. This is a thing that I'm uncomfortable with. I need you to be patient with me, or I need you to be accommodating, or I need you to communicate a lot. I think especially for people on the spectrum, that is a very important skill to learn. And that comes with, like, a trusting relationship with someone that you know will basically go, yeah, it's okay. Like, I will be patient with you. And I think that, you know, for me, that was like a representation I felt strongly about. Like, for me, that was something I experienced sexually, of, like, kind of not knowing what was okay versus not okay, both, like, kind of, like, expectations in the moment, but also having sensory processing disorders and, like, not knowing how I was going to feel, having partners be very accommodating and very patient and taking things slowly and checking in frequently, which I felt like he does really well in the book.
I like how he followed like her directions,
exactly.
By the way. Like
yeah.
her being like, don't wear cologne.
Exactly.
Like, don't
yeah.
don't eat lamb.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I'm just like, oh, those are like very specific
yeah.
things. But like he was like, okay, sure, I'm game.
Right.
Like he was
yeah.
like weird yeah. about it.
And I like how, so like it started off as a checklist for how to be good at sex, and then it evolved into a checklist of how to be a good girlfriend.
Right.
Which led the book into what Rira is probably her favorite genre of
fake relationships.
Relationship.
Yes. Yes. May that trope live on.
Which leads to like the family scenes and.
Right.
Yeah. Actually, like with Michael, we've mentioned that like there aren't a lot of books with like Asian male romantic leads. I mean, now they're like coming into the mainstream.
Now it's a thing.
It's a thing. It wasn't really quite a thing right. when this book came out in what, like 2018, 2017.
Yeah.
I mean, 2019, now you have Randall Park as the Asian, like,
you know, always be my maybe.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, exactly. We've yeah. evolved yeah. to like the non-Daniel Hennies as well.
Right.
Yeah. I like, speaking of that, I did have a little bit of an issue with the male characters in this book. They seemed all kind of like
macho.
Alpha macho. And I kind of wish there was a little bit more diversity with that. I know that past complaints from audiences have been like, well, not all Asian male are like super buff and like super like testosterone or whatnot. And I like totally agree, but this is also a romance novel. So I can totally understand yeah. like why you want your male lead to kind of look like Daniel Henney.
Exactly. I mean,
kind of fit like the conventional like
attractive.
boyfriend
yeah.
look.
I mean, if we look at this again as like a gender flip traditional rom-com, right? Like the girls are always, you know, the main lead, their quirky best friend, and then like the bad guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's kind
yeah.
of how we have Michael as the lead. We have Kwong as his cousin / like kind of
yeah.
best friend. And then
yeah.
we have, what's his face? Philip.
Yeah.
Philip James.
When
you meet someone with like two like first names as part of their name, you have to like be careful.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Caitlin, Kelly, I have two first names because the entire nation of Ireland only has first names. They dropped the O when they emigrated and it was all over for me. Yeah, and I think the only like kind of more sensitive male character you have in the book is Kai. He's the other like autistic character and he's the protagonist of
in
the
bride test,
which I had like complicated feelings on. But it is kind of interesting that like your only sort of more sensitive male character is like neuroatypical, which is like kind of a sort of like complicated also portrayal of like maleness and like autism spectrum disorder, which is like kind of like a bigger other conversation. But that was a thing that actually kind of like did bug me about this book. I was like, man, all of these dudes are kind of
yeah,
like a little
especially
toxic.
When like Kwan and Michael are at Michael's apartment and they're like drinking a six pack and they're like, dude, women, like,
yeah, exactly.
Man, you gotta fuck that shit. I'm like, really?
Like yeah.
Those were parts where I was just like, eh. And then especially with like the sex scenes, I'm like, he's talking about blue balls and I'm like, this can't be a thing. And actually,
right.
when I was reading this last night, because I read it the second time last night, I'm actually dating an autistic man.
Right.
So I was just like asking him, like, oh, is this how you feel during a relationship? Like, one of the questions that I've asked him was, Stella, in this book, she says, I don't like it when people treat me differently. Because, like, she's like, I don't want people to pity me. I don't want people to treat me as if I'm the label, as if my autism is, like, my entire identity, which is fair, which is, like, a valid perspective. And I asked Dan, I was like, do you feel like you don't want people to treat you differently? And he said, no, I wish more people would treat me differently.
Because, me too.
Because he's actually very similar to you, Caitlin, where he is very outgoing. And he was diagnosed with Asperger's when that was still a diagnosis. And he said that like a lot of the times people would be like, oh, you don't seem autistic. And then just kind of leave it at that without like really putting consideration into his like sensory stuff.
Yeah.
And like with Stella, it's like completely opposite. Like I feel like which is like a character growth in this book. Like she seems to think that her autism is a flaw.
Yeah.
Something that she has to fix in order to be loved. And Michael kind of has a similar thing where he has his own insecurities. He believes that, like, because of his dad's criminal past and also his financial situation, he just thinks that he's not good enough for Stella or anyone in that, like, economic, like, economic and educational level.
Right.
And I thought that was, like, really interesting because everybody has insecurities, whether you're, like, autistic, neurotypical, or you're a man, woman, non-gender binary. And I think that was like a really good message in a romance novel that I don't really see that often in other romance novels.
It's usually one person.
Yeah, it's usually one person. That has to,
and like, obviously everyone's like kind of, you know, growing together. Like if you look at Pretty Woman, for example, it's like he's also changing and transforming like his perspective on people. But it's fundamentally her who's being like, yeah, actually, like it doesn't matter that I've been a prostitute. Like I'm worthy of not just being like kept in this ivory tower. I do think that like on your point about Dan was actually really helpful for me sort of throughout the time that I've known him, like understanding my diagnosis and sort of like coming to terms with it. And I do agree with him that like, I wish more people would treat me differently. And in that, I mean that like, I would like more consideration from others of like how I move through the world and how it's different from them. I have had friends in the past who've been like, yeah, but like, I want to go to this thing. Like, why are you kind of being a wet blanket and not wanting to go? And like, now I can say like, well, actually I'm on the autism spectrum, so I'm not going to go to this thing and that's fine. And I am also, my parents should have like literally never bred and have kids because like I have two other disabilities. And so like for me, I also kind of related to this book and like those capacities as well is like there is a fine line between like you don't want to be treated like a stereotype or just sort of like cast in this like, you know, disability role while also needing people and wanting people to like recognize your struggle or what you go through or like accommodating you. And that sort of like difficult intersection of those two things. And when people do say, oh, well, you don't seem autistic, it's equally as like disappointing to me as when they look at me because my disabilities aren't, unless I'm using a cane, aren't obvious. And they go, well, you don't seem disabled. It's like, yeah, both of those are really bad things to say, actually, and you shouldn't say them.
I mean, even Michael, like once he kind of discovers and like piece puts it together, doesn't see her differently, but starts treating her with more care, which is what she needed.
Right. Yeah, but it's also like, you know, she's just like, oh, you're pitying me. Mm. And like, you were just going through this relationship because like, I don't know, like I am the poor autistic girl. And I was just like, and like that part, I was just like, like, I don't know, like.
That didn't resonate with me as much.
Yeah, I mean, it's different. Like everybody on the spectrum is different. And, you know, she's kind of, in a way, like she shows like very stereotypical symptoms of like autism that you do see on television, even though she is a woman, and that does make it like refreshing. It's like, oh, she's really good at math.
Yeah.
She's rich because all autistic people have to be super successful because of their genius brain.
Right. Which is like,
you know, which is
super, you know, opposite of reality.
Yeah.
So this book also has a dual narrative structure, right? Because you, not only do you see all the horny thoughts in Stella's head, you also see all the horny thoughts in Michael's head.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess we can kind of switch gears to Michael's side of the story, which he, like Reva said, he has his own, like,
he has his own
heavy
issues.
Baggage.
Yeah.
Right? You know what? He has his own daddy issues.
Man, does he.
Yeah.
A thing that I did really appreciate about the Michael chapters is that, like, and I, Rira had reminded me that I wrote this in my Goodreads review, like, way back when, which is that typically in narratives, like, disabled people, and even in just, like, life, disabled people don't often get to be sexy. And whether that's, you know, being on the autism spectrum or being physically disabled or whatever, that does fundamentally change your relationship with sex. And it's very easy to have partners who either, like, don't respect that, which we obviously see from, like, Stella's recounting of, like, her previous sexual experiences. But also through Michael, we get sort of a positive sort of different thing, which is, like, it doesn't matter to him that she's autistic and that sex with her is maybe different than, like, neurotypical women. He still finds her super sexy, which was, like, just really happy for me to read because, like, the amount of narratives that you get to see where disabled people, and in particular, like, disabled women, and whether or not you consider, like, autism as a disability is, like, kind of up to each individual person, but at least someone who is not, like, you know, neurotypical or falling in the sort of, like, ability spectrum, I think was, like, pretty groundbreaking along with all of the, like, representation in the book.
Michael is an Asian male lead. I don't know how many times I'm going to mention this in the podcast, but it is revolutionary because if you look at, like, film history and also, like, in literature, like, Asian men, I mean, they're seen as kind of like, oh, they're not attractive.
Right.
And they're emasculated, quote unquote. Right. And it's just like, okay, well, we see someone who is defying those stereotypes. Now I would consider Michael to be a stereotype because right. It's like, oh, buff Asian man who looks like Daniel Henney.
But, yeah, exactly.
You know, like,
but also loves clothes.
But yeah, loves clothes. That was really, really nice that he was in a trade that is typically, you know, very feminine. And
his mom is supportive of it, right?
Yeah. It was also nice to see, like, to see Vietnamese culture in his family.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that I really noticed was his family is a working class Asian family. And a lot of times when you see Asian families in media, they're always, like, middle, upper class.
Exactly.
Like, and, like, the reason she's supportive of it is because of that background where it's like, you gotta work. It's essentially taking the family business, right?
Right.
Like, what I really loved about Michael being, like, Vietnamese is that the family scene takes place in a Vietnamese household with, like, the altar, with peeling mangoes at the table, with, like, fish sauce. And it's just that visual is something you don't really see in romantic comedies or in mainstream media that often.
Well, I feel like a lot of the Asian representation that we have in mainstream cinema, especially that is being marketed to, like, white audiences, typically is very much, like, East Asian. And so you don't often get a lot of the sort of, like, you know, a Southeast Asian sort of perspective and, like, the sort of differences that fall into that. I know a lot of people, speaking as a white person. Who, you know, do have this either sort of, like, you know, the way that sort of a lot of white people describe Africa as being this sort of, like, monoculture. The same thing happens with sort of, like, all of the different regions in Asia. And so I felt like it was actually just really cool to see something that wasn't like, here's a Chinese family, here's a Japanese family. Like, it was a different place. And I think a lot of people don't really get to experience.
A lot of the relationship stuff with, like, the mom being like, oh, when are you going to have babies?
Right.
It's like, oh, is she a doctor?
To be fair, that was to both moms.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, the thing is, I know someone in our Goodreads forum said, like, oh, I thought Stella, I imagined her to be Asian at first because, you know, black hair works in math. But I was like, oh, but, like, the first chapter, like, they're at this really fancy, like, brunch place. And, like, the way that, like, the mom and the dad talks, I'm like, oh, this is, like, ritzy white people.
This is the whitest shit. Yeah,
it's, like,
exactly.
The whitest thing. And just, like, I also had, like, issues with Stella's mom because she was like, oh, I'm going to, like, acclimate you to being used to touching. And I was like, oh, that's, like, a thing that, like...
My mom did that, actually.
I know. That's, like, a really common...
I mean, it's a time, right? It's a time where people, like, you know, these days there's a lot more, like, studies, learnings.
Yeah.
There's a lot
more,
like, awareness of, like, the spectrum. But back then it was like, oh, you just have to overcome it.
Well, that was the thing that was interesting for me recently is in one of my conversations with my mom about it, she was like, yeah, it's actually really interesting that you ended up getting diagnosed because when you were a kid... like, really young, your dad and I sort of thought this was the case. And when we took you to a doctor for, like, something unrelated, they were like, yeah, I think that your daughter's on the autism, like, that your daughter's autistic. But this was, like, you know, in the early 90s. And it was kind of like, well, like, okay. And, like, so it wasn't necessarily, like, I don't know if it was an official diagnosis or not, but their kind of best advice to my parents was, like, yeah, you just got to get her used to the world, I guess.
Yeah.
Which like didn't work out super well.
Yeah, they call it masking in the community. And like that part was just like real, like with her mom.
That was difficult.
That was really difficult for me to read.
Yeah.
And but like you see like the contrast between like Stella's family and like Michael's family. They're both in very different economic circles, and also just like the scene where Michael goes to the benefit charity lunch or whatever, also a super white thing, by the way.
I mean, it's like the reverse, like it's the reverse family meet, right?
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but like it's like that moment where Stella's dad was just like, oh, like, what do you do? And he's like, well, like, I'm not going to say that I work as an escort. So he just says like, oh, I'm not really working.
How did you guys feel narratively about the sort of like social climax that happens with, because you have the sort of like, from my recollection, you have the sort of two things that happen, which is Michael getting into the physical altercation with Philip when he's like kind of forcing himself on Stella. But then you also have this benefit where there's like the kind of culmination of like, it's Philip's mom, right? Who is the sort of like overly attached patron of Michael. And I remember like both times I read it, I kind of like didn't really like how all of that played out necessarily, because I understood that it was like, oh, it's like, you know, Michael's past sort of like catching up to him being publicized, which I understood why that was happening, but I kind of felt like it somewhat distracted from like the sort of overall narrative of like these two different people sort of like coming together. So I was curious how you guys like felt about that.
I mean, in terms of like the narrative structure, I mean, this whole relationship has been based on like mutual misunderstanding of each other's intentions. And that's just it coming to a head, right? Where it just boils over. In that scene, I did like, and I think we was building this. There's a scene where Stella's dad is like grilling Michael about his background and why aren't you working? Aren't you ambitious? I like ambition. And it's a really great depiction of the privilege of not understanding what it's like to need money and to support your family.
With Michael, like all of his insecurities are in this scene. He's like, I don't have money. I don't have like a good job or like a job that I can be proud of.
That's worthy of Stella, right? Because he has his own inferiority.
Yeah. Like his sister Janie at some point says, like, oh, you're like the first girl that's like good enough for him, because he's always kind of aimed low.
Right.
And that's the thing. That's a part of his arc, because his mom is like, you've been working at the store for 3 years. Like, you know I have cancer, but like, I'm fine. Like, you're just being like, you're letting your insecurities hold you back. And
she Goodwill hunting him.
Yeah, she...
I think where I struggled was like the inclusion of like Philip and his mom in sort of like a lot of the sort of misunderstanding there. And I'm not quite sure like why that was a point of like big contention for me as I was reading it. That was probably the thing that like bugged me most. And I don't really know why.
I mean, I just chalk it up to romance genre drama.
Sure, that's fair. Right?
Yeah.
Like you got to have the big, like I think... They kind of Chekhov gunned it in the beginning,
and
it's like, well, you gotta fire that at some point, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I think for me, the thing that I was maybe comparing it to was Pretty Woman, where the sort of like big turning point that happens is when Jason Alexander, when he learns that she's a prostitute, tries to hire her, and then when she turns him down, he sexually assaults her. And that's when Richard Gere like comes back into the room and he like beats up his friend and is like, or lawyer or whoever, and is like, yeah, actually, like this is not okay. And that for her is her little moment of like, man, no one's going to see me as anything other than a sex worker. And that to me was kind of like an intimate moment that like was just kind of surrounding that central conflict. And I think for me, it was like the inclusion of the mom and Philip. I was like, this is so soap opera. Like,
Yeah, I mean, I can see your point, but also it was juicy. So.
Yeah, it was juicy.
Maybe this is my problem with romance.
I mean, I like how, well, I don't know if I liked. I mean, Philip was just like kind of a slimy dude in general. And he was, you know, he's trying to like.
I had an issue with that, but go right ahead.
Well, I mean, he was trying to like. I don't know. When he was trying to hit on Stella, he was like saying, oh, we both have issues. I have issues too. I was like, no, your issues seem more. person.
Yeah. He was also like very hypocritical, being like, I can't believe like he slept with my mom, and he's like hitting on an intern, and it's like still like really gross.
I mean, every one of these stories needs that guy.
But the thing is, I wish the second male lead wasn't that guy. Like, I wish that was like a different guy in the office who was kind of like more of a side character. I mean, Philip is a side character, but I just wish that like Stella and her family saying like, oh, Philip would be good for you. I wish he was like more of a gentleman who was like a very good guy, but doesn't understand that, you know, she needs considerations.
Right.
And I feel like that would have made it a more powerful arc.
Yeah, I can see that. I like making the climax about her choosing Michael over like the guy who's like on paper good for her. That would have been
nice.
Especially because like it for me, like with the representation of how socially she operates, I felt like Philip was just kind of like so obviously like gross that it didn't kind of make sense that she'd be like, yeah, I guess this is like, you know, maybe I should do this, maybe I should do that. I was like, I felt like he should have been, even if he like turned out to be super gross, it was like a little bit too, I think, apparent for me. It was like, oh, he's the gross guy. Would have like you said, like a little bit more gentlemanly, like, and then his ableism or his like insensitivity is revealed sort of like later on.
He was kind of a cartoon character.
Yeah, he kind of was, which goes back to like my criticism of like male characters. Like, I feel like they weren't as fleshed out.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to say, isn't that, but in itself, kind of refreshing in a way?
Yeah, no, I can get that.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's like the, like, oh, it's nice to have, like, a story where, like, the woman character is just, like, aggressively detailed and, like, the male characters are, like, kind of stereotypical.
Yeah.
It typically doesn't happen.
Because in the climax, in that, the scene where Michael punches Philip, it does end up with him coming in and like saving the day, which
okay, but the thing is, he doesn't save the day though, because Stella says, I have a taser, I know how to use it. You're not going home with me, like,
exactly.
And she just kind of walks away, which I thought was a really good scene.
Yeah
Sorry to interrupt you, I just wanted to make that known.
No worries.
But I did want to ask you, Marvin, since like, you know, like this is a genre that's like kind of out of your realm of comfort, I would say. Like, how did you see Michael as like an Asian male character in this book?
I mean, what I took away from Michael's arc in general is like a depiction of, again, like a working class Asian family. I think Michael reminds me of a lot of people I grew up with, where he feels this almost like intense responsibility to take care of everyone around him, especially because his shithead dad like ditched the family.
He's the only son as
And so he's taking on all the burden, and he kind of has like this hero complex, right? Like only I can be responsible for my family. I have to like make up for my dad's sins.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's why he takes up like escorting to pay for his mom's medical bills. That's why he, you know, put his life on hold.
Yeah.
Right. And so, I mean, it's an extreme version of this story, but I know this story. A lot of people that I know are this story, where like they weren't able to go to college because they had to support their families. They weren't able
to. They had to drop out. Stuff like that. I mean, we see it in, like, we see that kind of story with like white people as well.
Yeah.
But I feel like with, by making this character Asian, like it definitely brings like a specificity to it. And also like a lot of East Asians, I mean, Vietnamese is Southeast Asian, but a lot of people think that Asian families are really rich. Like,
Well, I think there's something to be said too about the fact that, like, you know, even like zooming in more from just like East Asian versus Southeast Asian, the representation that we kind of get here in the States, I think also like Vietnam and Vietnamese families occupy a very specific part of sort of the Asian American experience, given like, hey, guess what we did in Vietnam? Not the greatest. And so I grew up in Seattle, which was a very popular area for a lot of Vietnamese refugees to settle, just because it was generally like a much more sort of accessible part of the country. And because there was like a bit of a lower population and it was like a cheaper cost of living, you could like really easily start up businesses. And so I went to school with a lot of kids who were Vietnamese, whose parents had fled the war and were refugees and like, you know, had gone to Guam and then immigrated from there. And I think it occupies for sort of white audiences a place that like we typically, when we think of like Vietnamese people, there's a lot of just like, oh, war. And that's kind of like, you know, like the sympathizer, I would say, is like a much more of the story that like white Americans kind of get about Vietnam. And so I really appreciated just getting to see a working class family that is probably it for a lot of us is a lot more sort of accessible as what a working class Asian family would be versus like a lot of the Chinese kids I went to school with were a lot wealthier. And there was this sort of social strata even within there of like the complicated relationships of like colorism and classism and sort of how that came into play. Which I liked a lot more about this than if it had been like maybe a different representation.
Yeah. I like that he was the only guy in his family too.
Yeah. Definitely brings out like fleshes out his character a little bit more. I really liked the fact that like in his inner monologue, he says, all these women in the house don't know how to cook. I don't know how that happened. And I feel like a lot of Asian men know how to cook. I feel like that's just, yeah. I don't know. That's just a thing.
How did you guys, in terms of like Asian male representation, was it complicated for you as readers that he was mixed race versus not mixed race? Did that like bother you? Did that not bother you?
I thought it made sense because like, you know, his dad left and he's right. being raised by his grandmother and his mother who are, you know, Vietnamese. But they're...
The book portrays him as identifying probably more with his Asian side of the family.
Absolutely. Too.
And I mean, I think in general, Riri and I have a more, I guess, liberal conception of what being Asian American means.
Absolutely.
So it didn't like, I wouldn't say it probably wasn't even a thought. Like,
there was a paragraph where Stella is looking through baby photos and she's like, oh, like he's with all of his Vietnamese cousins and he's the only one who kind of looks different. And she says, I wonder what that's like, knowing that you don't fit completely on either side. And Helen Huang is actually mixed race. So I know that came from a place that is personal. But I really like the fact that that wasn't the entire book.
Yeah.
Like, it was just like, okay, well, this is part of who he is. Sure, he has issues with, like, his dad and whatnot. Right. And that's, you know, relatable. That's not, like, strictly to Asian culture being mixed race.
I think what's great about it is a depiction of, like, people who are typically marginalized in media. And, I mean, Michael's struggles are... struggles for not only people who have to live with like having like grown up in tough times and having a shitty dad, but it also touches on the struggles of like being mixed race and like it's no one's fault for being born.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? But then they had to deal with, you know, how the world sees them. And I think that's very apparent in this book too. I mean, one of Michael's biggest struggles is how his dad really like messed him up by telling him like, your only asset is your looks.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
And that's kind of something he internalizes.
Man, that's something that like girls hear all the time.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, the only way you're going to succeed is to like be pretty and to like marry rich.
But you'll also never be pretty enough in all the right ways.
God.
Yeah, and I liked that this book was really fundamentally about not just two people learning that it's, like, okay for them to be loved and actually that they are, like, worthy of love despite, like, whatever they have going for them that they feel insecure about, but also about, like, two people really sort of learning to, like, access feelings because that's, like, a big part of being on the spectrum that, like, a lot of people don't talk about is, like, a lot of times we get sort of cast as being, like, cold or unemotional or whatever, and it's actually not that, like, autistic people have fewer emotions, but it's also a lot harder for us to like process and identify them all the time of like a lot of times I just feel like question mark of like, I don't know what this feeling is and I have to learn what to do with it. But I also feel like that's something that like you see Michael having to kind of do in his own ways of sort of like learning how to process the sort of feelings of shame or sort of identify like, why am I feeling certain things? And like Stella bringing out other feelings in him that he's having to learn like what to sort of do with them. I really thought that was like a really beautiful way of telling a romance story of like, not just like, oh, I'm worthy of love, but like, oh man, how do I like become a better person through the lens of being loved?
Yeah. Moral of the story. Everyone has issues.
Everyone has issues. communication skills are key.
Yes.
Don't be ableist.
Setting boundaries is good.
Setting boundaries is good. Touches up on all of those things.
Yeah.
Overall, we're just going to wrap up. I know that this book has like a divided audience. There are people like me who loved it. And then there are people who found issues with it. And I think they're both very valid perspectives. But I think all of us can agree that this is like a milestone in not just like romance, but also just like in Asian American literature. And I just really hope that in the future I see more Asian male leads and also Asian women leads in terms of like romance and have it be all diverse. So this isn't the only representation of an autistic woman or of an Asian male lead in romance.
Well, things just being more complicated, I think a lot of these stories get sort of like distilled down to just like, you know, race. And that's like kind of the only complicating factor where it's like he's such a fleshed out person with a lot of different struggles. And so is she. And I think that's like fundamentally more interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, in general, I enjoyed reading the book. I liked how it was kind of like a rom-com in which, you know, besides all the very detailed sex scenes, all the horny, I kept reading because I really wanted these two kids to work out their issues and get together.
Yeah.
You know?
I just remembered like another issue that I had. I know that we're trying to end on a positive note, but I did have an issue with the insta-love of him being like, oh man, like I love her. And I'm just like, I wish that came a little bit later.
Yeah. It was the chemicals, the hormones.
The horny.
Yeah.
No, you have to draw it out a little bit.
No, Rira. Horny.
There's a difference between horny and like love, like horny versus insta love. I mean, that was a thing that I kind of bristled at, but you know, it is a trope and I'm like, whatever.
Positive side. I did like that because she's autistic, he didn't go like, oh, I don't know. Am I in love with her? He was just like, yeah, dude, I love this girl. She's my favorite. I was like, yes. Win for autistic women.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I really liked how he's just like, oh, yeah, I'm going to propose to you in 3 months because you hate surprises. And I'm like, that's really sweet.
Yes, I liked that. It was very good.
It was a great way to end it. Not sure how I feel about the epilogue. But you know what? Let's end on a positive note.
You know, yeah. I mean,
let it go.
At the end of the day, it is a feel-good, like, romance story. So, you know.
This is also being made into a movie. So, crossing my fingers that they cast right.
Yeah.
I don't know what right means, but, you know, once I see who is cast, I will get the feelings.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's kind of how I felt with To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which is kind of like the YA version of this book because of the fake relationship stuff. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I'm excited. Give me all of the adaptations of all the books that we have read in this book club.
And like there's a lot coming. Maureen Gu just got her adaptation of
I Believe in a Thing Called Love.
Yeah, which is the K-drama relationship, fake relationship.
Yes. Right? Well, no, that's not a fake relationship. She's faking...
But it's a checklist.
It's a checklist,
story, yes.
more checklists in books.
Well, on that note, that'll also do it for our discussion of our February 2020 book club pick, The Kiss Quotient by Helen Hong. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you for having me.
And Rira, what are we reading for the month of March?
We are reading The Map of Salt and Stars by Zane Jakhadar. I hope I said that correctly, but... yes, it is a book that that's kind of a dual narrative with two timelines, one set in ancient Syria and one in present day time. So it'll be interesting. It's a historical magical realism book. That is what has been pitched to me. So yay.
Great.
We'll see you at the end of next month. Hopefully you finished a book. Good luck.
And that'll also do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time.
All right, bye.
Bye, everyone. Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This episode was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and produced and edited by Marvin Yue. This podcast was recorded at the Potluck Podcast Studios located within the Visual Communications offices in downtown Los Angeles. You can learn more about Visual Communications and their programs such as the Los Angeles Asian Pacific Film Festival by going to their website at vcmedia.org. Thanks also to the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts that Books and Boba is a proud member of. You can learn more about our fellow Potluck podcasts by checking out the website podcastpotluck.com.
Hey, I'm Phil Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation.
The good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallsbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.